Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 28th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Globalization. Can't live with it, can't live without it. Session 1 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality. Some new visions for the future of God's earth and God's people. Presented by Jim Bowman. Number BOJ 2003-01. Let's listen in.
I'm Jim Bowman and I work on public policy issues for Lutheran World Relief. I've been doing that for about 4 years. Prior to that, I was in the staff of the Nebraska Synod for 13 years, and before that, the University of Nebraska for 16 years. And I am not an economist. It probably would be very beneficial if I had formal training as an economist if I'm going to talk about globalization. But the perspective that I come to this through is our experience as a relief and development organization working in a lot of countries around the world who are impacted in very negative ways by the kinds of things that are happening and have happened, especially even in more recent years. So that's the perspective out of which I approach this. And I would hope that as we're going along, if we've either rushed by something that you want some clarification on, that you would just interrupt whatever I'm saying to just help me go back and talk about that. Just also by way, just I'll mention these materials. My associate made me bring these. These are reprinting of what you may have seen before, coasters, landmine coasters, which say pick me up on one side and you turn it over and you'll get the message. It's obviously a landmine message. And help yourself to any of those that you want. This is, for those of you who may not have seen Lutheran World Relief's report for the current report, this is it. And this is a brochure that attempts to describe what our Office of Public Policy does, which is, as you know, Lutheran World Relief is located in Baltimore, and our public policy office is in Washington. We are located in the same suite for the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, and Lutheran Services of America are located. You're welcome to help yourself to any of these materials. This happens to be an excellent issue of a publication by the Mary Knowles called Center for, it's a Center of Concern, is their organization, and they do a lot of really good work on globalization issues, especially global finance issues. And this piece here is one issue of the Africa Advocacy newsletter that is a printing of the a conference that was held in South Africa called Prophetic Diakonia called to Advocacy, and you're welcome to that as well. And finally, this is something, I mean, you don't want to go home loaded down with stuff, but some of you are, I'm sure, are familiar with Bread for the World, and every year the Institute publishes just one of the finest studies of hunger issues in the world, and these are some extra copies that I brought with just because we don't like to see them sitting around. So you're welcome to help yourself to any of those things. What I'd like to do to get started is to just have you throw back to me a word or two at the most of what comes to your mind when you just hear that word globalization. What's the most immediate? Let's just sort of throw it up like popcorn here. Throw it out the word globalization. So give it back to me. What comes, what word or words? We're not looking at definitions now. We're just looking for just tiny word or a phrase. When you hear that word, what's the immediate association that comes to your mind?
Trade.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it all. What?
Interaction.
Exploitation.
Negative and positive.
Negative and positive.
Anti-democracy.
Okay, anti-democracy, okay?
Opportunity.
Free market.
Privilege and underprivilege.
Okay? Good.
And restrictions.
And restrictions, yeah. Well, the word obviously generates lots of emotion, and it generates lots of feelings. And when you, if any of you were in Seattle now, a number of years ago, you know that it generated a lot of feelings there. And it's continuing to do that as at every meeting of the global the trade ministers, the financial ministers, when they meet at various parts of the world, they are now trying to meet in places where it's inaccessible to the people who want to express some thoughts about this. So it's making an impact. What I like to do tonight in a very introductory way is to just talk just a little bit about the history, if it's possible, we'll talk about the history of globalization in a few short minutes. But I think it's important to sort of see it, begin to see it in terms of its context and where we are now. When we're talking, and then we'll go on to talk about some of the myths relating to globalization. Some of you who've been here in previous years may have had the opportunity. I don't know if you remember, were here last year, but I know Cynthia Molobe. What's her name? Cynthia
Lobeda Mo.
Lobeda. Yeah. Was here, and she's talking about globalization last year, and she's written an excellent book called Healing a Broken World, Globalization, and God. This is over in the bookstore, so this is a plug for that book if you're interested in reading that. The UK, the New Internationalist Organization, the UK publishes these wonderful, really pocket books that you can literally put in your pocket. This one is called, these are no-nonsense guides. This one happens to be on globalization. They've got it on trade, they got it on democracy, they've got it on a lot of different things. They're inexpensive, and again, I saw at least one over in the bookstore. At least it was one of those that I requested that they order. So I just mentioned that to you as well. If you're really serious about this kind of thing, you may want to pick up this one called Globalization in the Postcolonial World, written by another economist, sociologist in the UK. And that, I didn't order this one because it's pretty technical, so I didn't think that would have as much popularity. The World Council of Churches has recently published a little, these are very, very good introductions. This is called Economic Globalization, A Critical View and an Alternative Vision. And then this is Lead Us Not into Temptation, Church's Response to the Policies of International Financial Institutions, a background document. So, and if you were going to be, are going to be around next week, it's my understanding that several people who have been attending the World Lutheran World Federation meeting in Winnipeg will be here, and hopefully we will be able to utilize their experiences. Some of them are coming from, they're still coming, and we're able to get visas from Africa, Asia, or Russia, lots of different parts of the world. It would be good to have had them here for these sessions, but we don't have them. What I want to do then is start with just and the other piece of globalization that I am going to sort of limit myself to talk about tonight is what I call economic globalization. So that's the kind of framework, and obviously that's a big piece of it, but it isn't the whole piece of it, but I think to sort of give us some limits and some ways of approaching it, that's the framework out of which I'm going to be working. Trade, or economic globalization as defined by an expansion in the trade of goods and services has been obviously going on for a lot of years in this world. If you've read the Old Testament, you know that Israel was very strategically located in the middle of trade routes, and they were overrun all the time from the people in the south, trying to Egypt and Africa, and trade with the people on the north side of them, Babylonia, and then Greeks and Romans, and you know, they were impacted by trade. That's not the kind of globalization that we're talking about now, but it obviously was an expansion of moving goods and services around that have an impact on people, and many times it's a negative impact, and we'll be looking at those kinds of things. When we're talking about globalization today, I think it's probably more important to see it in the context of what happened about 500 years ago, in what I call the sort of the old era of globalization, sort of an era of globalization that went on for about 400 years. So when we're talking about, when I give you that clue, 500 years ago, what happened that sort of opened up a new era of globalization? What are we talking about?
Columbus,
right. Columbus tried to bumble his way to find India, discovered a place, and that has had, that really opened the doors up to a period of what we think of as European colonialism and expansion that basically created a conduit for all kinds of things, of basically raw materials from the various countries involved, flowing into European countries. And the there's a wonderful quote in here by Cecil Rhodes that you probably, Cecil Rhodes was the, where are we here, page? This kind of gives you the framework for how colonialism was defined. He's writing, Cecil Rhodes is writing at the end of the 1800s, in about 1890. He says, "We must find new lands from which we can easily obtain raw materials and at the same time exploit the cheap slave labor that is available from the natives of the colonies. The colonies will also provide a dumping ground for the surplus goods produced in our factories." Well, that gives you the kind of framework for at least one kind of globalization that really made an incredible impact on the incredible riches from Latin America. I've just sort of learned that in recent years, the extent, I'm more familiar with what happened in this country, but in Latin America, gold, silver, coffee, all was siphoned off into Europe, and it actually, the riches of Latin American countries was what sort of gave rise to the Industrial Revolution in that country. Canada, what came out of Canada to Europe?
Furs,
fish, timber, Africa.
Slaves and gold, every kind of mineral.
The Caribbean.
Cotton.
Rum.
Rum, yes. Sugar.
Sugar.
Fruits. Asia.
Spices.
What?
Spices.
Spices, yeah. Tea.
Rubber.
Gunpowder.
Firecrackers. Firecrackers, right. Now, it wasn't all a one-way street. I mean, I've described it as sort of all one way. There was investment that went from the north, but I need to explain this. I get caught in this language. When I say the north, I'm talking about sort of global north as opposed to the global south. And those of you who are familiar with that language, you probably just need to be explained to you. But from the north, investment did go to the south. And what did that investment consist of? It was primarily an infrastructure that made it possible for those goods to be produced. Railroads, dams. Cities grew up. It created a whole new landscape in many of these countries. And the capital transfer was interesting when you look at the 100 years between 1890 and 1990, there was actually greater capital transfer, in other words, from the north to the south. There was a greater amount of capital flowing from the north to the south in the 1890s than took place in the more recent years in the 1990s. I think that's something that we are always aware of. Now, what I'd like to do for the next few minutes is talk about what kind of changes have taken place in the last 100 years that have really put a new face on globalization, a face that wasn't there in this period that we're talking about from Columbus on up into the early 1900s. What happened that changed the character of the global economy?
The rise of multinational corporations.
Communication.
Okay, lots of things going on there. I think all of you gave the sum total in one chorus. I heard communications here. We're talking about basically technological changes in communications that have just revolutionized everything. We'll talk about the impact of that. But someone then said, keep it coming.
I heard multinational corporations.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The free flow of capital.
Free flow of capital.
Assembly line.
What?
The assembly line made it possible to flood the world with Model T Ford.
Yes. Well, except that I'm thinking of the assembly line more. That's true, the mechanization of that. But I'm thinking of that being more, I guess, more in the 1800s.
Transportation of all kinds.
Transportation.
Containerization.
Yeah. Incredible transportation. The air cargo traffic between 1985 and 97 tripled. In other words, 300% the volume of air cargo. Ocean shipping. The cost, and this is something else that happened. The cost of ocean freight since the 1980s per unit, if you would, you know, the cost to ship, you know, a yak a pound or a ton or whatever you measure, probably a ton, has actually fallen by 70%. The cost of doing that has fallen by 70%. So you have some incredible, the volume of course has gone up. So transportation is cheap, and you mentioned the. What has contributed to the lowering the cost of ocean shipping, as well as increased the amount of air cargo? What has made that possible?
Containers,
right?
Abundant fuel, cheap, I suppose. They have to.
Right, cheap fuel. I mean, if you've got incredibly cheap fuel, that makes that possible. Cheap in terms of
money.
We won't talk about how cheap it. I mean, we need to talk about how cheap it really is. But that's something else. The other thing that happens in the 80s is that you have this sort of free market notion developing, especially under the administration of Margaret Thatcher. It's in the UK at the same time that Reagan is elected here in this country. Sort of both of them were promoting a free market philosophy, and what What did that mean in terms of, what were the characteristics of that free market philosophy that was being promoted by, they didn't give birth to that, but it was under their administrations, of course, that gave shape to that. What characterized the free market philosophy?
Well, it meant that all kinds of regulations got flattened.
Mm-hmm.
Give you a dramatic example from Canada, which is that U.S. companies, particularly which own Canadian corporations, no longer had to, in fact, have on the ground a lot of subsidiary companies in Canada. They could do it all from the U.S.
Yep.
So breweries, for example, which were not using their full capacity like Coors, could suddenly do it all in one huge brewery in Milwaukee or wherever it happened to be, and supply the Canadian market. So, massive changes.
Massive changes. And those changes were, in part, they represented governments giving up their regulatory power all over the world. Not just simply, U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
That was just a piece of that. But you were also dealing with incredible unequal relationships in terms of power between the North and the South, in terms of the ability of a country to decide whether or not a transnational company was going to come in and do business. If they were going to be in the game at all, they had to go by the rules, and the rules were being developed and shaped, not necessarily by countries as such, but by organizations like the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, and then the World Trade Organization after that, and now a period of entering actually into free trade zones that are being negotiated as we sit here, and some of them, the NAFTA that took place, and now Singapore and Chile. I just watched a debate last week in Congress over the trade rules that are going to, the agreements that are going to be negotiated between this country and Singapore and this country and Chile. So you have some incredible changes taking place. But one of the things that you haven't mentioned, and it was something that wasn't even on my radar screen, is what's happened with not trade, but also investment. When you talk about the way in which investments are handled, you have a situation, and it's connected to the revolution sort of in communications and computers and the ability with just a press of the button to transfer millions of dollars overnight in order to earn a little greater interest rate. And you have and it goes along with the deregulation, where banks, insurance companies, and traders up until about the 80s, they couldn't do that. They were limited to operate in the countries. They couldn't go outside the country. Suddenly, that was removed, and you have them, people from Europe, from Japan, and from North America are expanding in the South, investing in quick schemes to get rich quickly. Usually, they were real estate, or they are anything that will turn a quick a profit. To give you an idea, and this is just money now, these are not goods and services that are being exchanged, which is what we think of when we think of as trade and investment. But this is just money that's being moved around the world in order to take advantage of interest. It's like what we could call a global casino. That's what it is. In 1980, the daily average of foreign exchange trading totaled $80 billion. In other words, every day in 1980, every day of that year, I mean, we're not starting about 1980. Every day, about $80 billion was transferred on the on the foreign exchange. All right. Today, this time, or at the end of today, about $1.5 trillion will have been exchanged on the foreign trade. Difference between $80 billion and $1.5 trillion. $2,500 billion was exchanged. So, and you couldn't do that without computers. You couldn't do that without deregulation. And it's and all most of this investing has nothing to do with goods and services. In 1998, the annual global trade in merchandise and services was $6.5 billion. So you see that $6.5 billion in goods and services was exchanged in 1998. That would be about 4.3 days of trading on the foreign exchange market. And that's really what led to the crisis in Asia that happened with Indonesia and all those that sort of collapse of the tiger economies, which was just a horrible thing, and people suffered greatly. Globalization is not just simply a set of rules or regulations or even economic or political arrangements. One of what Cynthia Moulubetis says that she says that it's actually based on an ideology or a myth, and she calls it the gospel of globalization, or the false gospel of globalization. And she has developed what, and she says, these myths of globalization form a view of human life, our understanding of the law of nature, and they are gospels that we have bought into without thinking, and we just assume that they're true. And it, I think it's very, very helpful for us to just take a look at some of those, a few of those myths. The first one is that growth, this is the false gospel now, growth benefits all. You hear a lot about growth, economic growth. If we can just grow the economy, we will, it's sort of, all the boats will rise. I mean, it's that argument, right? Now, what's wrong with that? If we have free and open markets, it's going to lead to economic benefit, and it's going to eventually benefit everybody. What's invalid about that? Why is that invalid? Thinking now to some of the things you've talked about in terms of globalization.
I've always thought of it as cancer, which is the only thing I know of that just grows exponentially and eventually does you in, which is what happened apparently in the Asian market.
Right.
Grew and grew and grew, and then all of a sudden it killed me.
Well, first of all, we probably should talk about the measurement that's usually used for growth is the GDP, which is the gross domestic product, and the gross domestic product is the figure that is the total of the amount of goods and services that are both produced and paid for. In other words, you just can't simply measure it by the number of things that you've produced in the economy. You have to actually sell those things that you produce, and it's that figure that is used to measure to measure whether or not economic growth has taken place. That's the measurement that the economist uses, the World Bank, IMF use those figures. But that measurement falls short for a lot of reasons, and one is that it fails to account for what we mentioned earlier, some of the true cost of that cheap oil that fuels the shipping and the airplanes that are flying this stuff around. It doesn't measure the impact on the environment. There's no figure put on that. It doesn't distinguish between what we would call destructive or sustaining economic activity. All economic activity is measured as a positive. So that if you have 10-year-olds, this is not a good example because they would be not part of the economy that's recorded, but if you have 10-year-olds purchasing cigarettes or alcoholics feeding their addiction or the sale of pornography, they all contribute to growth as measured by the GDP. Right? I mean, those are the negatives. They also treat the depletion of natural resources as an asset. And so if you cut down a forest in the Philippines and you sell it, it shows up as on the plus side. It's part of the economic growth. And especially if that forest is home to indigenous people who are now suddenly without a place to live or without sustenance or livelihoods, that cost then is going to be borne by future generations. Usually that isn't figured into the gross domestic. The other thing that growth theory fails to take into account is the way in which wealth is distributed. Economists like to, this is a good example, economists like to point to a growth in what they call the average household income in the United States from 1983 to 1998. There was a 22.2% growth in the average household worth. All right. Yet we all know that during the same period there was a growth in homelessness. More people couldn't get health care. Many of our citizens lost their jobs and experienced economic insecurity. What these figures don't do is spell out that during the same time, the income of the wealthiest 1% of the people in this country just skyrocketed, while the middle and lower income families saw their income shrink. So while the average income, because that's the way it was figured, you figure the average, yes, it increased. But during the same time period, if you figured the median income, which is really the important figure here, the median income actually decreased by 10% in this country. So when we use these figures, and of course, a lot of times, you know, people who work with statistics can kind of make things come out the way they want to. You have to be careful about the figures that you see. And I think, finally, the other thing, the gross domestic product attributes to the host country corporate profits, which are actually returned to the company's home base. So that if you have a transnational company that is operating in Colombia, for example, and they generate income there, it's shown as though it's it's shown as part of the domestic product of that country because it's a good that's produced and sold. But the profits come back to rival countries, especially if it's oil. So the questions that need to be asked, I think, when we talk about growth benefits all, the questions that need to be raised is growth for whom and growth at what cost. That's the question that I think people of faith need to raise. If you're talking about growth, who's benefiting, and what is the cost of that? What is the cost of that benefit? A second market myth is that human freedom and market freedom are inseparable. What do I mean by that? I think you've heard that kind of claim that human freedom is grounded in private property, and the freedom that I have to do with my property as I please in the marketplace without any restrictions. So labeling economic and financial activity as free, the terminology that we sometimes associate with sort of our freedom as our rights and associated with the freedom of the human spirit or political freedom or moral freedom and democracy is just an inappropriate connection. And why is it invalid? Well, that version of freedom just simply is inconsistent with the reality of countless people whose freedom to survive is actually threatened by free trade and investment. An example of that, I think, that is an example that brings up another area is the impact of the World Trade Organization's intellectual property, trade intellectual property rights. Farmers in India, whose ancestors developed seed strains of rice and have been doing that for hundreds and hundreds of years, actually aren't able to even use that rice because a Texas-based company called Rice Tech came in, slightly altered the basmati rice, and so the Indian farmers, they have to, if they want to export that rice, they have to pay a fee, patent fee, to the Rice Tech for the right to do that.
Didn't Rice Tech lose that case?
They lost it, yes. But I mean, that's what they were attempting to do. The rules under the WTO can allow that to happen. We have the pharmaceutical companies were doing that with HIV/AIDS medicines, and that's something that we've gotten involved in. They backed away from it, not because. Just because of pressure from the public and from other governments, it was a way of embarrassing them. They just realized they couldn't do that. We could spend a whole time talking about pharmaceuticals.
Well, the whole question of patenting the human genome and all of that is a major error which we have not gotten resolved.
It's really opened up. We'll talk more about that when we, I don't know if we get to it this week or if it's next week, but we talk about the issues of agriculture we have programs in Peru, and our partners in Peru are telling us that companies from the U.S. are coming down there. Well, Europe also, but more in the U.S. are coming down there, looking at some of the medicines that have been developed by indigenous people for various, to solve various problems. One of them is, amusingly enough, is a Viagra type, are supposed to do the same thing behind this. And they've been apparently using this for years for that same purpose, and they're trying to patent that and market it. And then of course the whole issue of seeds and life forms, which is another area, is a very difficult issue. Thousands and thousands of dollars are being spent on lawyers to try to promote or keep things from happening in that relationship. I think that, I won't take the time to write these down. Another market myth is the human being is above all an economic being. I think that's a real something that it sort of arises out of our understanding of the driving force in a capitalistic system is consumerism. That's what drives it. If you can keep people consuming enough products, you can keep the economy going. And people are treated as not as people in community, but people who are individuals if you can encourage them to spend their money, then you can keep the economy going. My wife, we had a granddaughter here a couple of months ago, and she started to go around the baby store. She hasn't gone to baby stores very much. But she said she went to a store, and you probably have seen this store. I never heard of it before. The store it just sells stuff for babies, and the name of it was Bye Bye Baby. Have you heard that? B. I don't know how they spell it. It's B-U-Y, I think it's, or B-Y-E, but it's obviously a play on that word. And she said she went in there, and she just sort of got almost physically sick. She had to turn around and leave. She couldn't believe the way in which these things were being marketed. Well, what happens is that with this kind of a mentality, you get such vast disparities again. And you probably have heard these figures that the money spent on pet food, I hope none of you are in that business, because it's a poor example of that, but the money that's spent on pet food in North America and Europe would more than pay for the basic education and installation of water and sanitation for all in the world. I encourage you to look at the board outside this wall, this meeting room sometime about the water, the issue of water in the world. It's a very informing kind of thing. Or maybe this may not affect you either, but the amount spent annually on perfume by North Americans and Europeans would cover the basic health care and adequate nutrition for all who lack. So these are the kinds of economic disparities that sort of give you a vision of how we're framing, how our economic system is working or perhaps not working. Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament prophet, a wonderful study or Old Testament theologian, says, consumerism is not simply a market strategy, it has become a demonic spiritual force among us. The final market myth is that corporate and finance-driven globalization is inevitable. That is, you can't, historically unavoidable. So that we really can't do much about it. It's going to happen, we might as well just sort of learn to live with that. But I think that it's within, and this was where we will go for those of you who decide to come back the next time when we do this. They keep changing. I mean, I don't know when we do this. Tomorrow sometime. But tomorrow what I'd like to do is is to begin to develop some alternative visions of what the global economy should could look like. One of my frustrations in the work that I do, it's so easy for advocacy groups to find fault, and this is basically what I've been doing all evening here, is finding fault with a system, but fail to provide any alternatives to that system. And it's especially true if you're involved in advocacy work. If I go up on the hill and talk to a senator about, our policies in Colombia aren't working. We're not getting rid of the drugs down there, and it's not a more peaceful place. So they come and they say, well, yeah, we agree with you, but what do you suggest we do? You know, what are your suggestions? And I think that's sometimes where we haven't thought very disciplined and or creatively about how we can do things differently. And I think that's what you see a little bit of that in some of these books, but a lot of the books that you read and a lot of the people you see on TV, they're pretty good at criticizing the current system or finding fault with it. But you don't see very many of them talking about more positive ways of shaping, and we mentioned that, at some of you at the beginning mentioned the opportunity, I think was one word that was mentioned, the positive side of things. In a sense, we are stuck with certain aspects of globalization. You can't turn back the clock, but how do we shape where we are now so that we can make life better for a tremendous number of people around the world who are negatively impacted by it? I guess what I would find helpful if you could share some of your examples of where you have seen some of these myths functioning in your own experience that we've talked about. What kind of experiences have you had, or personally or know of, where even in your own faith community that you're a part of, that, you know, are these myths that you're familiar with? Are they something that you're struggling with, or you know people who are struggling with them?
This is not an example of one of those myths, but perhaps another another myth that is quite current is the idea that concentration or centralization produces efficiency.
Yeah.
And we have a member of our congregation who worked for a small company that was very efficient and very effective, and their company was bought out by a larger corporate entity. And this person eventually resigned. You know, the new company, he was just appalled with, you know, the inefficiency of that company, because it wasn't living as close to the people that are actually being served. It wasn't, they followed standardized procedures that would really stifle creativity. You know, the people that worked for the company really did not have the freedom to, you know, to develop in creative ways and use their gifts. And so he's published a book, I wish I could remember the title of his book, where he really talks about really calls into question that whole idea of economy of scale, that, you know, the bigger you are, the more, you know, efficient you're going to be. And
I think the difficulty, you know, that we've experienced, and I don't know how you move towards that, is that there doesn't seem to be a sense of responsibility to the community. And we've seen those changes. I mean, I've seen that those changes, and maybe they're inevitable. In rural, I grew up, when I was in high school, I lived in the country, but the town I went to was like 600 people, right? So it was a very small town. But, you know, at one time, that town had a movie theater, it had a pharmacy, It had a funeral home. It had a little dry goods store. It had all of those services. It had a bank, and then, of course, two Lutheran churches, one German, one Swedish, and a Methodist church. But you know, even in my own lifetime, I could see what was happening. People got better interest rates in the larger town down the road, so they took their money to that bank. You know, larger shopping malls came into Kearney, Nebraska, so people even went past that town to get, you know, more choice of goods. And so they still usually went to the local mortician because it was really embarrassing. You can't really go out of town and get married. So he was there till he died. But you know, now they have nothing. I mean, they had two little grocery stores, and you know, there was the, you know, but the fault, I mean, it's happening all across, you know, rural America. I'm sure it's happening in other countries as well. But there wasn't a willingness of the people in that community to give their business to the people who lived in that community. And then after they failed, they complained about having to drive so far to get things done. So I think it has led to a lot of disconnectedness, a sense of, you know, there was a guy in the East Coast. It made the news because it was so unusual. he was in some textile business, or he had some, you know, fairly large company that made clothing of some kind, and it burned, his building burned down. He was near retirement. He could have folded up and gone home. You probably heard that story. It's a wonderful story. He kept his people on, kept them on the payroll, even though they weren't open doing business, you know. It was a wonderful story of a commitment. I mean, and it took a powerful, you know, personal commitment on his behalf to do that. And the people, I mean, he opened up, he rebuilt, he opened up. People didn't leave for other jobs. They stayed there, went to work. They opened up. I mean, those are the exceptions. They're not the rule. And yet, you know, the kind of things that we're doing. I mean, I don't know how, if you've tried to challenge these. If everybody did what my wife accuses me of not really contributing to the economy, because probably everything you see me wear here this weekend has either been given to me, or I buy it at a thrift store for about 50 cents. If you see anything new on me, it's because my wife has bought it for me. She just can't stand me wearing what she calls dead people's clothes, you know. So this is sort of how I try to deal with it. It's not going to solve problems.
If you talk on a global basis, though, one of my concerns would be is that developing countries who need markets for their goods and services cannot get them, because the developed countries will not allow them to come in, free trade or not. I mean, look at the French agriculture.
Yep.
Still subsidized up to the yin yang.
Yeah.
Can't get your products into France.
Right.
So
right.
All of that, so it's all part of the GATT thing and how this works. Let alone talking about third world debt and the problems
we're
running out.
We're trying to, there was a big article in the Washington Post a week ago about the problem that Vietnamese catfish farmers were having. I don't know if you ever read that story. It was a fascinating, fascinating story. The trade agreements that we had, you know, supposedly we have free trade. I mean, that's another myth. We don't have free trade in this country. We set up all kinds of barriers. And that's, I guess, Friday's or Saturday's program. But these catfish farmers in Vietnam, and when we say Vietnam, we're talking about North Vietnam now. They were importing these fish fillets to the U.S. and they were getting opposition, of course, from the catfish farmers here. The catfish farmers in this country are mainly from the south, and they're not huge transnational corporations, and they basically employ a lot of poor people. So it's not a sort of a Cadillac business. So the the catfish farmers in the South were saying, they're competing with us, and we want tariffs put in place to keep that from happening. And the decision was just made last week, and I've got the clippings with me, and it's a very complicated story, but the entity here in the United States that determines that finally made the decision to put on a tariff of between 34% and 60%, which basically puts the Vietnamese people
out of business. Your Commerce Department, in other words.
Yeah, right. And so you have, I mean, that's the kind of thing you get into. Here you're trying to encourage the develop. They're looking for a place for their products. They've got the ideal, you know, they've got the ideal climate, and they can do this. They've got low labor costs, but people here are throwing up the roadblocks for that to happen. And it goes sort of against what our own gospel is, which is free trade. You know, we aren't. And it's all distorted. I mean, I could give you examples of the trade, the tariffs that are placed. Just to give you a bizarre example, there are no tariffs, practically no tariffs on expensive silverware. But the cheap silverware, there's high tariffs. There are no tariffs on lace panties for women, luxury items, but cotton, in other words, cotton, simple cotton panties, there are tariffs. And there's been a very interesting study that's been done on the impact of these simple tariffs that we have in this country on single women who are poor, because they have a greater share of their income has to be spent on clothing for their children and, you know, some of these cheap goods that are imported, especially shoes and other things. So so we don't, those aren't the considerations that we have when we create these barriers that are who's so the question that we keep asking, who's benefiting from these policies and who's not benefiting? Who are the losers and who's making the decisions? And that's hard to, it's very complicated. It's hard to even get at the truth to find out what is happening. And it's a very difficult thing to impact and to educate, especially, people in Congress don't even know how it works. When you get them over to the Agriculture Department or the Commerce Department or the U.S. Trade Representative and all these rules. So we have a lot of work cut out for us. I don't want to. I'm looking at the time. We've got one or two more minutes.
On the other hand, in agriculture, for example, we subsidize our agricultural system so heavily that we can export goods and underprice homegrown products in developing countries.
Yes. Yeah. And we criticize the Europeans.
Yes.
That's what made me so mad. I try not to be partisan here, but it's so difficult not to be. I mean, the words that come out of our leaders' mouth, you know, criticizing the Europeans for their subsidy of agriculture. How deceitful can you be when we're doing that ourselves? And I have, my wife's family are farming in Nebraska. They're big corn farmers, you know, and they collect the checks happily. And they are, especially true in the case of, we are putting, there's a wonderful story about chickens that we are dumping in Mexico. Poor people in Mexico who are sort of trying to raise their own chickens can't even compete with these chickens that are come out of these factories in this country that are processed, cut up, and sent down there. It's putting them out. They can't even, you know, these poor people can't even compete with that. It's cheaper to buy a chicken leg, and they, you know, from wherever it comes from in this country. And it's those are the kinds of things that we as an organization become aware of, because we're trying to work with developing, strengthening the livelihoods of people who are very poor. And when we see these kinds of policies affecting them in that way, it's, you know, the word comes back to us, can't you do something about that? Well, it's difficult to say we probably can't, but we'll try. But I think as people of faith, that's part of what we have to do. We have to, and thank God that we have people and individuals who are active and who are knowledgeable about these issues and who are doing something about it. But it's a difficult thing to just, I think most people don't understand how trade works and the impact that it has. We don't see that over there. We may see it in our own community, some small examples of it. But anyway, let me leave you just with a quote here from, this sort of sets the stage for what we're going to do next time, and that is a quote by Adrian Rich, in a more positive vein here. If the imagination is to transcend and transform experience, it has to question, to challenge, to conceive of alternatives, perhaps to the very life you are living at that moment. So, the question I leave you with is, what would happen in our daily economic life if freedom to acquire, consume, and promote unqualified economic growth in a global marketplace without counting the costs were challenged by freedom from that orientation? Thank you.